Father, what page is it, Yosef?
Page
8. It's a very fortunate, auspicious number to start. So you can chant along with me. Yosef, Bhagavan. Sama Sambuddho Savakato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo Supatipanno Yasa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadhamang Sasangang Ime hi Saka Rehi Yatharahang Arotite hi Api Pujayama Sadhu Bhagavā Suchira Parinibhutopi Pachimajyanata Nukampamanasa Ime Sakare Dukatapana Kalabhute Patikanhatu Amhakang Vihavatang Hitaya Sukhaya Alahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadehi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vijacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhamma Sarati Satade Vamanusana Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamani Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandhisiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachata Veditako Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamani Supatipanno Bhagavato Chant where we can sit comfortably. And that is done in English. Here we go.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Three he's, he he he. Very good. So that was the Loving Kindness Sutta translated into English. There's some great little sayings in there, such as let them be contented and easily satisfied, not proud or demanding in nature. So it was nice and easy to please.
Very good.
Now, some more, some extra.
Very good. Oh, that was run away.
Okay, here we have the questions. And just to let you know, I'm glad you've got the thing. Anyone who's got any hearing impairments, you have these wonderful little machines over here, which means that you can listen to whatever I'm saying with clarity. You can even go outside to the toilet and you can still hear me. You can go to bed, you cannot escape from me. But there's also a little knob there. You can actually turn my talk off. So if you get fed up with what I'm saying or old jokes, you can turn down the volume and escape. So a very wonderful little thing here which somebody sponsored so that you can, everybody can hear. Anyway, what can I do to relax and get a good sleep at night? So first of all, don't worry about getting to sleep. And there was a time when maybe, I don't know why, but 3-4 years ago, that I was difficult to get to sleep at night. I don't know why. I couldn't figure out any reason for it. But there were times when I thought, oh my goodness, if I don't get a good sleep now, I've got to get up in the morning to give a talk or to lead the chanting. There's no one else to lead the chanting. Oh my goodness, I better get to sleep quickly. Otherwise, I'll be really, really tired. And all the people who came all this way from Hong Kong, come from Indonesia, they get so disappointed if I fall asleep during my talks. You know, there was actually a monk who did that in Thailand. It was really weird because he'd give the talk on the moon nights, and he'd be up there giving a talk, and then he'd fall asleep. And the weird part was, we didn't know when he was going to wake up. And when he did wake up, he would actually continue exactly from where he left off. If you recorded it and actually took out the moments when he was fast asleep, it would actually flow beautifully. I don't know if there's a name for that in sort of psychology or whatever, but that was what happened. But the worst bit was,
You know, is he going to do it for 5 minutes or half an hour? Is he going to do it for 2 hours? So we didn't know whether we could escape or not. Anyway, to relax and get a good sleep at night, that's one thing, is don't worry about when you're going to wake up. So just, this is one of the great advantages of a place like this. You don't have to worry about getting up at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Just whenever you go to bed, then you just relax, rest, and when you get up, you get up. Because, you know, you have breakfast and lunches, but, you know, if somebody's really sick, we know, we'll make sure you get plenty to eat. Because, you know, the compassion is the most important of the precepts. Kindness. And so when I was thinking, oh, I've got to get up at a certain time, that was the worst thing, you know, to make me sort of go to sleep at night. So instead, I just, oh, I get up in the morning. You don't get up in the morning, so what? You know, I don't have to impress people anymore. You know, I'm a monk now. If people like me and think, wow, what a good monk, oh, that's great. If they think I'm a hopeless monk, a terrible monk, a lazy monk, whatever, that's even better. Because that means I can, don't need to go teaching all over the place. I can just stay here and just have a nice, easy life. So either way, I win. I always make sure, whatever what happens, it's win-win. You know what? People ask me, why do you keep telling terrible jokes? And that was my plan for many years. Keep telling the same joke really bad every time. So that after a while, people get fed up. And they leave me alone so I can just become a hermit again. But no, every time I tell a terrible joke, they groan, but they want more. I don't know, how many of you heard the Einstein story? A few of you, but anyway, I can really relate to Albert Einstein's experience when he went on his first tour of the United States. Now remember, Albert Einstein, so many years ago, really well-known, famous genius of a scientist, but those were the days before television, before internet. The only way they could understand that there's this genius over in Europe was from the newspapers. And when they saw a photograph of Albert Einstein, you know, it's a grainy photograph, it was not high definition in any sense. So when they invited Albert Einstein to go for a lecture tour of the major universities on the East Coast, they, you know, sent him a ticket. And when he arrived by the boats, like they had in those days, arrived at New York, they had a comfortable car with a chauffeur to take him around. And the chauffeur, you know, the same chauffeur, the same car, to university after university after university, where Professor Einstein gave the same talk. You know, it's not on internet, not on YouTube. So he didn't have to worry about me, what I said last week, because it was all new to everybody. So Albert Einstein gave a talk in one university, then stayed there overnight in the car to another university. And the chauffeur happened to mention to Professor Einstein, I've heard your talk so many times, I think I could give it myself. And many people tell me that. I've heard that joke so many times, I think I could tell it. And so Professor Einstein says, yeah, well, let's give it a try. Let's do an experiment, see if they know the difference. And so just before they got to the next university, they swapped places. Their chauffeur went into the back of the car, and he borrowed Albert Einstein's pipe, because professors in those days had pipes. And he roughed up his hair a bit, makes it look like some crazy scientist. And Albert Einstein put the chauffeur's cap on and the front, gave up his pipe, and just drove the last mile or so to the university, where the vice chancellor of the university, oh, it's a great honor, Professor Einstein, as he opened the door in the back. It was really the chauffeur. And even though when the chauffeur came back, oh, wonderful, Professor Einstein, referring to the chauffeur as Professor Einstein, opened the door, Professor Einstein, the chauffeur, got out, and even though the chauffeur could speak in a Brooklyn accent, that they never guessed that it was just a chauffeur dressed up pretending to be the great professor. So they took him up to have the dinner, and the chauffeur, really Mr. Einstein, had to go and have something simple with the servants. And when they got to the lecture, the chauffeur went up to the podium. And the chauffeur, because he'd heard the same talk so many times, gave this perfect rendition of the intricacies of general relativity and the nature of this universe. And people were so impressed, they all stood up and gave the chauffeur a standing ovation. Brilliant, groundbreaking, amazing. Except for one professor. And that one professor was a bit doubtful. He never heard a Professor Einstein look so young, and again spoke with an American accent. So he asked the question, Professor Einstein, he asked the man at the podium, and he asked this very deep question on the nature of space and time and gravity. And the chauffeur looked at the questionnaire and said, Professor, that is such a basic, simple question. Even my chauffeur sitting in the back could answer that one. And the chauffeur stood up, really, Professor Einstein. So often that can happen. I'm really related to that story, because I'm sure if one of you just came up to the front, who would like to... may that just... No, to shave your hair off, put a pillow or cushion under your... and then you can get away. Once upon a time, there were two bad bricks in the wall. But when I tell stories like that, oh, just relaxing, go to sleep. I didn't mind. You wake up in the morning, you don't wake up, you know, you wake up in the afternoon. When you don't worry at all, it was easy to go to sleep. And sometimes I thought, hang on a moment. My bed, as a monk, you know, you've got to sort of do so much work and stuff and sitting cross-legged. You know, if you've been sitting cross-legged, meditating for a while, lying down on a sort of a comfortable mattress, on a nice duvet or blanket, it's one of the most comfortable positions in my day. Relax, laying out. Have you ever had that experience? You wake up in the morning and you've had enough sleep. You don't need to go to the toilet. It's just so nice and cozy. It's why that some genius invented the snooze buttons on your alarm clocks. Because it's so comfortable. You don't want to get up. You just put a snooze button and stay a little bit longer under the pillows. It's nice and cozy. So I worked on that principle that when I was asleep, or not asleep, so when I was awake, I couldn't go to sleep. Who wants to go to sleep? This is the most comfortable position I get into in the whole day. Relaxed, warm, cozy, snuggling in to my pillow. Who wants to miss out on this wonderful, cozy experience? So I said, I don't want to go to sleep. And as soon as I thought that, I fell fast asleep. Because I know the psychology, when you want to go to sleep, you can't. When you don't mind, go to sleep, don't go to sleep, then you do. And number two here, or number three or four, but I don't know, stories, anecdotes you say about sleeping. But I did notice on these retreats that, you know, sometimes that people come up to me and they said, oh, just... they couldn't go to sleep at night. And even though you've got these wonderful rooms all by yourself, personal rooms, and you've got your own suites, and it's really comfortable, and we put a lot of funds and effort trying to make these rooms comfortable for you, but people can't go to sleep. But then, when they come in the morning to meditate, They're fast asleep. So after a while, you know, you just use, you know, your logic and reason. I say, now obviously you can understand the reason why. When you try to meditate, you fall asleep. When you try to fall asleep, you're wide awake. So, if you ever have sleepiness in this meditation hall, when you come in here, try to fall asleep. Then you'll have no sloth and torpor at all. You'll be wide awake. Your mind will be... And when you want to go to sleep at night, you go into your room, you lay down on your bed and you try to meditate. Then you go fast asleep. Now, of course, you know, that's, I've exaggerated the point there just to make it very clear that what is going on there? It's wanting makes you tense. And that tension stops you going to sleep. So you just relax, go to sleep, don't go to sleep, doesn't matter, either way, it's fine. And then, okay, if I can't sort of go to sleep, I'll just meditate. Just make my mind really peaceful. So nice, peaceful, still, cozy in my bed. And then you go fast asleep. So, and there is also the fact that, I mentioned this to someone earlier, that when I was in San Francisco to this big conference in Berkeley, someone actually came up to me and they said, Ajahn Brahm, I have to admit this, that I sleep with you every night. I said, what? And I wake up with you in the morning. What? Are you going to sue me? I'm innocent. You're mistaking me with Mr. Einstein or something. That's not me. And there was a joke, I knew what they were up to, they said, I listen to your talks, you know, every night on an iPod or something, that's why, and I fall asleep, you know, with your sound in my ears. And I wake up because I haven't sort of turned off the machine, and I can wake up with, so I go to sleep with a monk, and I wake up with a monk. And I've got to explain what it means, because you know, sometimes people sort of, no doubt what you say, but you can, this is what I mean, a lot of people, my talk send them to sleep. But it's a good thing, because it relaxes them. So that is how we just go to sleep. We relax, but don't try to go to sleep. Just relax, and that's where you find you go to sleep. But wanting to go to sleep is not relaxing. And then you get a good sleep at night. How and why people lost their memory when reincarnating. If you remember all your memories, it gets really complicated if you remember your past life. Imagine this life, okay? This life, you got your wife, you got your kids, you got your mother-in-laws and stuff. Imagine that in your next life you remember all of that. Oh, that life is complicated enough. You know that sometimes that people, they get married and they get divorced and they get a second wife and they have this kid and this kid is even your father or your uncle or something. And this life is so complicated. That just complicates things more, if you remember. This is a true case. This is one, I haven't seen her for a while now. This one woman here, Sompo might know her, but she, she did a clear memory of her previous life, and she was in one of the villages in the northeast of Thailand. And she, her son from the previous life was a very good, devout young man. He did well at school and even went to the university where he studied education and became a teacher. So he was a teacher at a local school. And eventually his mother died. And his mother died and was reborn in the same village as his niece. So the teacher eventually by this time was the headmaster, the principal of the school. And so that his sister gave birth to this little kid, and she had perfect memory of her previous life. So everyone accepted, oh, that's the headmaster's mother from previous life, now the niece. It was all very interesting until that little girl went to school. And when the little girl went to school, there was very strict discipline in Thailand in those days. So when the principal, the headmaster, came into the room, every child had to stand up. But this girl, the headmaster's niece, I'm not standing up for him. He's my son from a previous life. And so even the principal didn't know what to do. I mean, how can you cane your mother? So he couldn't discipline her at all. She said, I could do whatever I wanted in that school. I didn't learn very much, didn't do very well, but had a wonderful time. Because the headmaster, you know, realized that little kid was his mum from a previous life. It does make things very complicated. So because of that, that's why it does seem to be that the memories of one life stored in our brain, but also leave an imprint on our mind. And so when we die, the brain gets destroyed. With it, all the sort of the hard drive of the memories all get destroyed. But the mind serves as a backup. Just think like things stored on Google Cloud. And you can access them from anywhere, even if your hard drive just, you know, gets busted up. Still get another hard drive, as long as you know the passwords, then you can get into your memory bank from a previous computer. A previous device. And that, you know, may be how it works. But it's stored in your mind rather than in the brain. And that's when it gets really fascinating. But you can see just how, and these are stories of people who get the memories of past lives through hypnotic regression. And, you know, I think many of you know our current president and Dennis Shepherd. He sometimes does these regression therapies and he's really good at it. And you get these really interesting results. Not always, but sometimes. And he said that, this is not his clients, but one of his friends over in Sydney. So these amazing stories. One of the most amazing ones, when one of his friends over in Sydney was doing a regression of a young girl, she was only about 16, who had anorexia. And a really bad anorexia. You know what anorexia is? I looked it up once in a dictionary, and anorexia means you look in the mirror and you think you're too fat. And I realized, that's what I have. Well, I look in the mirror and every time I look at it. But anyway, this was serious stuff. So this poor little girl had anorexia. Doctors, psychologists, therapists, no one seemed to be able to solve the problem. And she was really getting really sick and maybe even dying. So her mum took her to this regression therapist just to see if it could help. And because, you know, she was only 16, and the therapist, or the hypnotherapist, was a male, mother had to be there all the time, you know, because of this sexual abuse stuff which happens, unfortunately, in many, too many places. So, the therapist did an amazing job, got this 16-year-old girl back into sort of, into hypnosis, and back into what she claimed to be a previous life, and she recalled in a previous life, and I don't know how many, 50, 60 years ago, that she had a sister, an elder sister, and both her sister and her fell in love with the same guy. And she was so jealous that this guy chose her elder sister, and she thought because her elder sister was more attractive than she was. And it sort of broke her heart to such an extent that in her previous life she said that she committed suicide. She killed herself. She couldn't stand the fact that she'd lost the love of her life, this guy, and her sister had married him. And you can understand why, in some sort of perverted way, she thought the way that to stop that suffering happening in the future was to be as attractive as she possibly could, starving herself with the idea that really thin people are attractive to males. So, that was an interesting story. Except that while she was relating this, her mother was going hysterical. And this poor therapist, imagine this therapist was trying to look after this young girl. She'd just, regressed and gone through a memory of suicide and deep depression. And then she also had to deal with the mother who was going crazy. So had to calm both of them down and then ask the mother, "Why are you going so hysterical?" At which the mother said, "I was that elder sister. I never told my daughter that in our family that your auntie you never met sort of committed suicide. It's the sort of thing you hide from your family. You don't sort of go advertising it. So my daughter never knew that my sister, her aunt, committed suicide, the only sister I had, because that's what happened. We both fell in love with the same guy. I married him. It's her father. And she committed suicide. And she's come back as my daughter. The one way she can get close to the man of her dreams, but not as a lover or as a wife, but as a daughter." Interesting just how karma works. And anyway, so if she'd remembered that from the day she was born, that would have just made things so complicated. Which is one of the reasons why those memories are just almost wiped. And not totally wiped. You can access them sometimes, if you really want to. But sometimes, do you really want to? Being compassionate and relaxed seems not easy in the workplace. How can I apply these during work? Compassionate and relaxed. So at least you can apply that during your lunch break. Do they employ you on the weekend? Actually, they don't employ me, but I work weekends. It's weekend now, isn't it? I'm still working. I work they have something in Australia called penalty rates. If you work on hours when you're not supposed to work, you get extra pay. I have to work at 6 o'clock in the morning to do the charging, and this is 8:30 at night. That should be penalty rates. I do night rates, early morning rates, weekend rates, holidays. Holidays, that's when I really have to work hard. Compassion and relax is not easy during the workplace, but of course you can do this. Now, of course, you can take some 5 or 10 minutes out. This is the story which... some of these stories I actually invent. They come from me. And then it's wonderful. You see it going around and round and round. And then somebody comes up to me. One of the first times was a local politician, the member for Perth. Because it was a Thai ceremony and it was held in town. And it was the, not Songkran, it was the Loy Kutong ceremony. And so the local politician, they always need a few votes, extra votes. So they came to this ceremony. And they were up on stage, I was in the audience, and she said, "A wise man once said, and the cup isn't heavy, it's only because you've been holding it for too long." And I said, hey, that's my story. I started that one. It was great. I don't mind. It's wonderful that people share it. But it's amazing how far it goes around. And there's another conference. This is over in Singapore. And it's one of the people I know for such a long time over there. She did a presentation of one of the latest therapies from Sydney. And she said that the problem with people is that it's not problems, it's just like the hand. Hand is not too big, it's only you hold it too close to your eyes. That was my invention as well. No recognition, no royalties, no cultural appropriation or something. Anyway, he's making a fortune out of that, so anyway, good on him. Anyway, where was I going? This thing over here. That's the problem, is when we have a difficulty in our life, and it becomes so dominating, we're obsessed with it. Is it really a problem? I'm really sort of going on tangent after tangent after tangent here. I'll come back to the simile of the cup and how to relax at work. But this was a story I was recalled only recently about a person who described the difference between an irritation and a problem. Because there was a backpacker, an American, who was many years ago, and you know what they would do? I remember touring around Europe this way as well. You know, you get to a destination, and then you get a job, any job, in a restaurant, in a cafe was one of the best, because you get free food, and you get tips as well, and, you know, you could find a nice cheap place to stay at night, and then you save up enough money to go to your next destination. You'd work your way around some of the most beautiful parts of Europe that way. You know, cheap job, but at least you get food. So this American was in Vienna. Now, enjoying the beautiful sights of Vienna, staying in a small little pension, a little place that didn't cost that much. And you get a job in a restaurant, you know, washing dishes, maybe serving, and you get free food. But then, one day what happened was the owner of the restaurant made a mistake. He ordered too much sauerkraut, this pickled cabbage. And some people love that. You know, if you ask those of you who know Amandus, you know, Bodhinyana Monastery, he loves that stuff. Can't get enough sauerkraut. But most people think it's just stinky cabbage and can't stand it. And this American sort of didn't like sauerkraut. But then the owner of the restaurant said, we've ordered so much sauerkraut, the only way to get rid of it is from now on until the next week or two, if you want any free food, it has to be sauerkraut. Anything else you have to pay for. He can't do that to us. You know, this is understood. If you work in a restaurant, you get free food. I don't mean the food which has got too much of like sauerkraut. This is not right. This is not what I signed up for. This is wrong. And we should actually stand up for our rights, you know, in the kitchen and in all the people who work there. He's really upset. Can I understand why? But then, the chef, this old man came out, the head chef. He said, young man, I want to tell you the difference between an irritation and a problem. And he rolled up his sleeve, and there was the tattoo marks of the number which he had on his arm from Auschwitz. And he said, I was in Auschwitz for about 6 months. Every morning when I woke up, I didn't know whether I'd go to sleep that night or whether I'd be dead. Many of my friends, my relations, my people, obviously people I didn't know, many of them disappeared during that daytime to the gas chambers. Every day I didn't know whether I'd be one of those people executed. But I survived, I made it. Living in Auschwitz is a problem. Eating sauerkraut is an irritation. Remember that. And there's a beautiful story. sometimes that somebody bangs the door. Somebody leaves peanut butter on the knife, which is the only knife you have to butter your toast or whatever. Those things are irritations. They're not problems. So when you keep it in perspective, so much of the things which we suffer with in our life just vanish. They're irritations, but they're not really a problem. It's just where we have a hand, we hold it too close to us. And then we feel that that's the biggest thing in the world, we get obsessed with it and we can't see it past it. Put the irritation where it belongs, the hand where it belongs, the end of the arm. It's still the same size hand, still the same size, you know, irritation, but you can see beyond it and around it, you're not obsessed with it. That was the symbol of the hand. And anyway, back to the main story. The water at work. How can you relax at work? And this is something which I developed and which is in Harvard Business School. It should go to many more places. How heavy is my cup of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, I'm in pain. 2 minutes, in agony. 3 minutes, a hospital case. You have to take me away in an ambulance. I'm also really stupid. Why would I torture myself so much holding this cup when it's too uncomfortable to hold? So what should I do? Put it down. Not throw it away. Take some time out just to relax and rest your hand and arm. And you can try this for yourself, like any good scientist. It should be repeatable to prove that it's right and it works. After 1 minute, you pick it up again. It actually feels lighter, honestly. And I can carry it again for another 3 or 4 minutes before I start to get tired again. The workload you have. Your kids, you know, doing studies for their exams. Secretaries, you know, doing the emails and just trying to. Have you ever noticed there's a time when you just get stuffed up in your head? You just, the words just don't come out. You can't figure out solutions. You know, basically you can sit at a computer screen or your laptop and just produce rubbish, if anything at all. Because your brain is just exhausted. Imagine the alternative of just relaxing, going to do some meditation, even listen to some soft music, anything, so you're not actually striving to produce anything. You're relaxing. Then you go to the work afterwards, after say half an hour, you've got ideas. The words, the sentence structures comes out, and you get 3 hours work done in 2, of high quality. Not for forcing your brain. There's times when your brain is not productive. It's not efficient. When you can recognize that through your mindfulness and wisdom, that's the time to rest. I know I'm talking to many people here from Hong Kong. It used to be part of the British Empire. You know why the British lost their empire? I'll tell you why. It's because they were so wise that they used to have a tea break every morning. And they used to have a lunch hour and a tea break in the afternoon. And because they would relax morning, lunch and mid-afternoon, it was their brain was more efficient. But nowadays, people work right through the morning. They don't relax and rest at all. Neither do the Brits, which is one of the reasons why they've lost their efficiency. That's my theory anyway. Probably doesn't make any sense at all. But nevertheless, you can understand just how, without a break, your brain makes too many mistakes. And it doesn't produce. And it's not that you have to keep on working. Stop. And you produce more. Once there was a man who went to work, I also went to Canada, in the north of Canada, logging. You know, it is plantations, so environmentally okay, sort of. But anyway, the boss gave him a chainsaw in the morning, and that fellow is a big guy, and so he cut down many trees that day and filled up his quota. The second day, he was working hard all day, really struggling to keep up the quota, but maybe 70% of the quota, that's all. And so he had to go home, too dark. So the next day, he arrived early, and this time maybe only 30 or 40% of the quota. And so the boss came, "What's going on with you? You know how to use a chainsaw, there's enough." "What's your problem? You're not sharpening the saw." He said, "I've got no time to sharpen the saw. Look, I only get such an amount done. If I waste time sharpening the saw, that's wasting time when I'm not cutting any tree, I'm not producing. Too much waste of time." You can understand that simile. Of course you've got to stop cutting the trees so you can sharpen the saw. So otherwise, you just lose all your efficiency. And that's just the same as people trying to force themselves to finish the work. You've got to sharpen this saw up here so you can actually produce things efficiently. Yet, while you're sharpening your saw, you're meditating or relaxing or resting, you are not actually producing at that time. But you are getting your mind in such a good shape, your brain is relaxing, so that when you do go to computer or whatever, you can produce. Called efficiency. That's how you can be compassionately relaxed in the workplace. And you can be a big producer. Look at me. Do I work hard? I produce. It's amazing. You know, recently when I was in Melbourne, I'll answer some of these questions sometime this week. When I was in Melbourne recently, just giving some talks last May, just somebody came up to me and said, "You know, the old, do you remember me?" And, "No, please don't do that to me." But anyway, she was the publisher of my first book, The Opening the Door of Your Heart. And when she said that, I remember her name, because she had an unforgettable name. Magnolia Flora. Very flowery name. Belonged in a garden more than an office. But Magnolia Flora, she smiled, and she brought back all these memories of just, you know, the first book which I wrote, and how efficiently it was written. No stress at all. So when I decided actually to write it, the first is 108 stories there, you can check it out. The first half, 54 stories, I just wrote in 2 weeks. 1 hour every afternoon. I just put 1 hour aside for writing those stories. And it was, I'd meditate before. Nice meditation, nice and peacefully, get out a piece of paper and write it down, longhand. No computer. And some of you have seen that because I think, Hugh sort of got it in auction, raising money for the Nuns Monastery or something. And I think now Hugh has given it over to Cecilia, wants to put it in the museum. But even I looked at it, it's almost unbelievable, no mistakes. Just no nice, neat writing. Just, you had a little whiteout pen, there's hardly any whiteout on it at all. Just absolutely flowed. And flowed and flowed and flowed and flowed. There was no resistance to my mind. It was just very still and peaceful mind just writing it. And so I had a break after the no stress of 1 hour for 14 days. And then just had a rest and then wrote the other half. Similar. All just perfect writing. And just, but of course, even no matter how perfect it's written down, you have to send it to an editor or send it to some sort of publisher. So I did get somebody to type it out for me. they typed it out on one of the old CDs or floppy disks, whatever you call it. And they did that, and there was so much time because he's an old fella. And but he finally finished it the day before I was about to fly off to Melbourne. There's lots of publishing houses in Melbourne, not many over here in Perth. So he gave it to me, and I had it in my yarn, my bag. And you know, our first stop after leaving Perth was Melbourne University, giving a talk there. And this girl, you know, she, my memory is fine that she said, yeah, this is what happened. She was at my talk, she listened to the talk, and she came up to me afterwards as people, oh, thank you, very nice talk. Look, she said, I work in the publishing industry. If you ever have something you want printed, please let me have a look at it first. And I literally just handed it to her. I never sent that thing around to different publishers. It's much easier than Harry Potter, because apparently J.K. Rowling, she was rejected by 6 or 7 publishing houses before someone actually published her, but me, no. Just I don't even have to look for them. They come looking for me. Here you go. And that's done very, very well. I like those sorts of stories, that just when it's in the right place, it's hardly any effort at all, even in business. It just flows so easily. Why? You're relaxed, efficient, and you really do a lot with hardly any effort at all. And certainly not tired. If I do get tired, I usually meditate and recharge. Anyway, that's in business. There's many business people, especially that I know quite a few now getting to know in Hong Kong, but really sort of top CEOs in Singapore, do lots of interesting stuff about trying to change that work experience. He was the head of the Changi Airport Group. He was just the following day after giving this talk together with me, he was about to open Terminal 4 in Singapore. And he said, you know, a lot of people complain about the work environment these days. It's just so tough. And he said, but how many of you go to work in the morning resolving to make one person happy? At least. And I was the only one who put my hand up. That's my job, to make people happy, I suppose. But everyone else expected the work environment to make you happy. But you never actually went in there with an aim to make another person happy yourself. And of course, expecting that to come from somebody else, or from the boss, or from the system, or whatever, you're missing an opportunity. So you go to work, make a resolve to make one person happy, at least, to be kind to one person. And then it just changes the whole work environment. And that came from this really, G-O-H, but really sort of great CEO who can actually change work culture by encouraging each one of you when you go to work to resolve to make one person happy today. Imagine what that happens in the culture. Huge. Anyway. Ajahn Brahm, today I noticed jealousy arise in my mind. I reflected, there's no owner of gains or pleasures in the 5 sense world. How should one skillfully deal with jealousy? The work environment. Would you like the promotion? It's crazy having a promotion at work. I mean, think about it. What do you get if you get promoted to a higher position in work? More stress. That's all. But you get more money? Nah, it's still not enough. So, let the promotion go to somebody else. The only reason why I didn't get promoted to being an abbot or a teacher is just the previous one left. And so I never expected it. I never saw that one coming. So I was left holding a baby in Bodhinyana Monastery. So anyway, you just make it happen, it's okay. So, jealousy. comparing other people? Sometimes we always say, if you're jealous of, say, your husband, you should walk a mile every day in his shoes. If you walk a mile in his shoes every day, then you'll be a long distance away from him by the time a 3 or 4 weeks comes past. In other words, if you actually get into somebody else's shoes, and if you could somehow live their life, and then say, what am I jealous for? That sometimes we think, oh, they're so privileged. But privilege comes with responsibilities, duties, and what was it that there was these two Thai girls? Actually, they still come every now and again, see them. These two Thai girls, sisters, they both had these different problems. The first sister, she had a husband causing her a lot of strife. And she was really wondering. She came to me for advice, should I carry on with this terrible Australian man? Or should I just give it up and get divorced? And so she was having a lot of problems there. She was basically got a husband she didn't want. And then her sister was single. And she had this weird, she managed to find sort of a guy would go out with her for maybe a month or 6 weeks at most, and then the relationship would fall apart. And she said, something must be wrong here, because it's easy to date a guy, a nice guy, but it never gets anywhere. And it's been happening so often. So her problem was that she was single and wanted a guy. And so the problem just appeared to me, just a stroke of genius, like Eureka. Your sisters, your elder sister's got a husband she doesn't want, and you want one. Swap. Yeah, your family, you share. And to this day, I don't know why they can't accept that. It was an obvious solution. But then we got to the jealousy part. And the reason I tell that story, because I said, when I got serious, I said, your elder sister, you've got what we call, and I think many people understand this, many women understand this, you've got what we call husband suffering. If you get rid of your husband and become single, then you've got what your sister has, single woman suffering. So if you become CEO of a company, you've got CEO suffering. If you're number two deputy, you have deputy suffering. If you retire, I don't need to go to work at all, then you've got retiring suffering. Not enough money. So some people say, I know how to get rid of all this suffering business. I'll become a monk or a nun. And if you become a monk, you don't have CEO suffering, you don't have money suffering or work suffering or marriage suffering. What do you have? Monk suffering. You can't get away. You just change the different types of suffering which you have in this world. Because just changing the situation is not getting to the root of the problem. So jealousy, aren't you happy with what you've got? What do you want? If I had this magic powers and I could with my wand, this is not really a gong bong, this also is a wand, and I can bong, would you wish? If you had a wish, what would it be? Just have $1 billion? Would that, you'd like to be rich? I've seen many rich people, they're not happy. There's one lady who was really rich. I went to her house, it was in Shelley. This is waterside suburb in Perth. And when I went there to do a blessing, she was a Thai lady. And then, honestly, no exaggeration, coming all the way from Serpentine over there, I need to go to the toilet, first stop. So where's the toilet? She drew me a map. Inside her house. Because some of these mansions are so big these days, they come with GPS. for Hong Kong, you haven't got enough space for that, but there's huge places where people could stay. And then, you know, when I came back, I was just making small talk and said, how many people live in this mansion? She said, only me. And, oh, that just, my heart sank. Well, what about some of your friends and loved ones, relations? He said, no, I don't trust them. Because every person that came into that house, especially relations, wanted to borrow some money. She's even a bit dubious about me. What, you're trying to get some money for a donation? And people don't trust one another because they just think that, you know, she's can loan her money for this or that. So that's why she had no friends. She lived in that house by herself. And to me I said, just how sad that is. You'd rather live in a small house where you've just got your friends and your kids and relations and goodness knows who else. Have a lot of fun. But she was imprisoned by her wealth. So when I saw that, oh, I don't want to be like that ever. Or over in, Malaysia. I won't say which big CEO, big mansion, tried to get into his compound. They had guards, you know, with machine guns, private security, to get in there. And I thought, this guy is living in a prison. Are those guards, you know, to keep bad people out? Or is it the same as they have guards in prisons to keep people from leaving? And the simile was just so striking in such a mega wealthy person was actually a prisoner. Couldn't go wherever he wanted. Or he'd be taken around with guards, just like you were, just in jail. So anyway, so it's jealousy, if you actually get to know what it's like being in that position, you think, oh, this is good enough for me. So, how's your husband? Would you, you're jealous of someone who's got someone who's much better than that? A big, better earner? More attractive? Younger? I was joking with our committee on the week, just on Friday. Because I've got this award in the Queen's Honours List that's going to be awarded in Government House next September. And I got the letter, allowed to take 4 family members or friends. I don't think you mind me saying this, but I was saying to one of our executive members, so, oh, you know that one of the other people who's got this award is Hugh Jackman. He's West Australia. He's in the Queen's Birthday Honours List for this year. And apparently, he's a really famous film actor. I think the monks told me that he was in Wolverine, yeah, in X-Men. And as soon as I said that, one of our senior members of our committee said, I'll volunteer to come to your investiture. Not because she wanted to support me, to have the chance to see Hugh Jackman, because she thought he was really hot. And I said, he probably won't be there. He said, okay, I'll let somebody else go. I think he was just messing around and joking. But imagine a person like that. How much freedom do they have? Anyway, to deal with jealousy, what was the last little story? This was from the suttas. There was a king who's coming back to the palace. This is in the time of the Buddha, with his military. And he passed these 2 mango trees. One tree had so many fruits on them. It was dripping with delicious. You could smell the mangoes on them. And the other tree was barren. Had no mangoes on it at all. And he thought, somebody should cut that tree down. It's just not producing anything at all. It's just, you know, there's the wood and nice leaves and branches, but it's got no fruit on it. There's another mango tree over here. Just look at all that amazing fruit. I'm going to come back here after changing, going back to the palace, come back and eat some of these mangoes. So he went back to the palace, got changed. When he came back, his soldiers, they hadn't waited to get changed. They just went for it, and just they were ate so many of those mangoes and broke the branches off, climbed up the trees. They destroyed that tree with all the mangoes. There's no mangoes left for the king. It had been ravaged. And then he looked at the other mango tree, which had no mangoes on at all, but was left alone, safe, unharmed, not damaged. And he made this wonderful piece of wisdom. He said, I am like that mango tree with so many mangoes. I'm a king. Lots of power, lots of wealth. Sooner or later, somebody is going to be jealous of my power and wealth, and they're going to destroy me. Before that happens, he said, I'm going to abdicate, become a monk, and be that mango tree with no mangoes on it at all. Left alone, healthy, lots of branches and leaves, but no fruit, which anybody wants. And he abdicated and became a monk. I always remember that story. It's just, are you jealous of other people's wealth? Other people's wife, husband? Sometimes it's the jealousy. You don't realize the value of what you already have when you look at what others have. It's not worth it. Just be happy with who you have. I know everything about marriage. How do I know? Never be married. But husbands, they're all the same. So if you swap the one you have for something different, you'd be terribly disappointed. Wives, women, they're also the same. Like cars, different chassis, same engine. That's all it is. So just the one you have is good enough. Anyway, the main switch has been tripping a lot today. This is normal and had happened during winter time when too many heaters are on at the same time. I suggest it may be a good idea to lower the heater settings in the rooms. If they are high, 5 to 6 or something lower, it may stop it from tripping too many times overnight. Or you can ask Ajahn for suggestions. Yes. Sometimes it's something called Buddhist climate control. Because sometimes it is cold, sometimes it's hot. So how can you use Buddhist climate control without sort of tripping the power? When it's cold, keep a warm heart. And when it's hot, keep a cool head. That way you don't need to waste any energy. And you can be peaceful throughout the whole of your life. But sometimes when it is really cold. Is it really cold? Number one, don't look at a thermometer. Because you know, sometimes, and I've done that, just, you know, you're just really happy, nice and peaceful, just meditating, so like, wow, it's 4 degrees today. Wow! And because it's supposed to be cold, it is cold for you. And other times, sometimes over here in Perth, it's 40 degrees. And I was doing fine, I was just meditating. Yeah, it's a bit warm, but you just go slowly and enjoying the day and just not running around too much because it's a bit warm. And say, wow, it's 40 degrees today. 40 degrees! Wow, that's too hot! As soon as they say it, it actually feels hotter. And as soon as they say how cold it is, you look at the temperature gauge, it actually feels colder. Just the psychology of it. So, number two, if you are really cold, then just get out there and just wash the dishes and do something, get some exercise going, just sweep around and just run around the compound a couple of times. That'll soon get you warmed up. No one ever does that. And so if you're too cold, you can just get into your... Sometimes putting heaters on is an easy thing, but then you heat up the whole room. How about putting a blanket around you? Or just getting a beanie? For those who have no hair. And when you put your beanie on, I'll put socks on as well, and just, you get nice and warm. So little things like that. It saves a lot of electricity. But I also, when it gets really cold, I sometimes remember, whenever I remember this story, it always warms me up, about these Tibetan monks. Now, in the Tibetan plateau, many monks, actually, and nuns as well, they go in these caves on retreats. And of course, there's no air conditioning in the caves. There's no oil or gas heaters. You know, there's no electricity. There's no fuel anywhere. Maybe get some wood somewhere, but that's really rare to find. So, those caves, they're not for the people who have not developed their meditation. So they can develop this meditation, this inner heat, especially to get that coming up. And they do this meditation to develop this inner heat, but they have to have a test first of all, the exam, to see whether you can control this inner heat enough so you can go and live in the caves by yourself. And when I first heard this, I thought, I'm never going to feel cold ever again. I like Theravada, I don't want to go into Tibet and be a Tibetan monk. Because you know what they had to do? That the test was they take them out in the winter time, in midnight, when these cold winds were whipping across the snow fields. They had to take all their robes off. Now, it hasn't even started yet. It gets much better than this. But they were allowed one blanket. No robes, but a blanket. But the blanket was dipped in the water of one of these lakes that break the ice on the surface. And they'd wrap the monk up with this ice-cold water. And the monk had to dry 3 blankets in one night to pass the test. Now think about that this evening, and you won't feel cold. So that's what. Anyway, how to keep the mind stop thinking when practice meditation? Why does the mind think? It is because you're not enjoying the silence. I noticed when I used to enjoy. Especially, I already mentioned I used to like rock music when I was young, but just before I ordained, I just loved classical music. And I wondered why. I was meditating at the time. Why did my favorite composer was, many people won't know this fellow, Monteverdi. And I could listen to that for hours. And why? Afterwards, when I became a monk, why did I enjoy that? And one of the benefits of that, if you're listening to classical music, you have to be right there every moment with every note. You couldn't think. Because the music was so delightful, it stopped any opportunity for thinking. Because you'd miss the flow of the concerto or whatever. And that was one of the reasons why it was enjoyable. So enjoyable, I never needed to think. And a lot of times, all your thoughts, especially when you don't really need to think, is just escaping, because you're not enjoying whatever you're experiencing right now. It's just a way of avoiding, you know, this moment, which to you is not pleasant, is suffering. And thinking is an escape. It's one of the reasons why during this retreat, and it's a nice sunny afternoon, don't sort of sit on the ground or just, you know, try and stop the mind from thinking. Go and have a cup of tea and watch the trees grow by the dining room. And you're just there, you're just sitting there watching the trees grow. Nice, beautiful birds come along, or the breeze comes, and you can see the clouds or the sunset. And you'll notice, if you're watching the sunset, just watching the trees grow, that's just an excuse for doing nothing. If you're doing that, it's so delightful watching nature. And you notice that there's enough to occupy and satisfy your mind. You don't need to think. And you don't think. You're silent. The problem is, with silence, people don't notice it. They take it for granted so much, it's just not there. But it is. Many times, when you come into this room, what do you notice when you come into this room? Buddha statue, the fat monk, the other people here, the walls, whatever. Do you ever notice that there's more space in this room than there are people? Emptiness is the greatest thing in this room. It's always there, but we just notice things rather than what's between things. And when you come into this room and notice how much there isn't in this room, rather than how much there is, then you also understand how much silence there already is in your mind. You haven't trained yourself to notice it. You just notice the events called thoughts. This is how we explain these events to ourselves in words and language. We only notice the events in our minds, not the silence. It's really cool when you start to notice the space. That's one of the reasons why it's sometimes really hard to actually to get a retreat center like this and have few things in it. The only flowers which we have is, you know, these plastic ones over here. Can't we get some flowers in here to worship the Buddha, make it so small, bright, and like, leave it alone. Leave it empty. The walls, can't we put some pictures on the walls? Give it some atmosphere. No, leave the walls nice and simple. So you don't notice things here, you notice what's not here. So when you're watching your mind, you're not watching the thoughts and problems. You're noticing what's not there. And that's where you can notice the stillness and the silence. Come to this place, Jhana Grove, you notice what's not here. No business, no TVs, no cars, no aircraft, no people hassling you, no traffic jams, no shopping malls. All that stuff which can sometimes dominate our world is absent here. We notice what's not here. It's beautiful. When you notice what's not in your mind, you find peace. So you don't need to get rid of anything or get anything more. Just notice a different way of looking at your mind. Where you can notice the space between words. Even when you think, there's lots of gaps between your ideas. We don't notice them. We only notice the events. What is intelligence anyway? Intellegere. To read or to see between the lines. The emptiness and space between things. And that becomes really cool. You get into that, it finds how easy it is to... You don't stop thinking. You look at the places where you aren't thinking. You notice that. You don't do anything. Because the silence is already there. Once you can notice it. And then the silence grows. Gets really cool. Beautiful. Okay, one last question and then sometimes people need to go to the letting go room. The toilet. So anyway, one more question, is that okay? Very good. Dear Ajahn, good evening. Good evening, good night. I heard from your morning talk the following. Relax and be a passenger in the journey towards enlightenment. I want to ask why we are a passenger but not the driver. I'll finish off here. Does it mean in meditation we need to play a passive role, so we have to put our mind in a passive mode? Yes. Because if you do stuff, it's just more of the same. You get these inspiration, and then you get, when it doesn't work, you get desperation, and you finally finish off with expiration. It doesn't work, because you're going the wrong way. You're doing things. The opposite. The talk I gave last Friday night at Nolamara, somebody asked me to talk about stillness. How can you be still when you're doing stuff? Sometimes people say, I'll just get this finished first. Get this thought, get this work done, and then I'll find some peace. That never works. It's one of the reasons why, to really get some peace in your mind. Peace is already here. Stop doing things. Looking for it somewhere else. So, in order to be a passenger. A passenger, this is actually straight from the texts. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. That's from Visuddhi Magga. If you try and do the path, you mess it up. You let go, and it happens. It's a deep question, but my goodness, okay. The donkey and the carrot. I'm going to do this later on in this series of talks. The donkey and the carrot simile. You all know donkeys are the most stubborn animal in the world. You get a stick to try and beat the donkey to pull the cart, it will not pull the cart. But you don't use a stick to hit the donkey. You tie the stick to the donkey's neck, so the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot, if you like carrots. But if you are from Indonesia, maybe a durian. Nah? A mango? Hong Kong? What would you like in Hong Kong? On the end of the stick. What fruit would you like? Apple? A longan? Okay, longan, okay. So the other thing, have a longan. And so, the Hong Kong donkey sees a juicy longan on it. Oh yeah, I like that. So what does the donkey do? It moves towards the fruit. But as it moves towards the fruit, the stick moves, the string moves, the longan moves. So it doesn't matter how long that donkey strives, runs, yearns towards that longan, never gets there. Because when the donkey moves, the fruit moves. Now that's like life. Sometimes fulfillment, meaning, peace, whatever you search for, you can actually see it. They move towards it and it goes away from you. But the donkeys in Hong Kong and in Indonesia, because they have listened to Buddhist teachings, they know how to meditate, they know how to let go, they know how to stop and be a passenger rather than yearning or striving towards the longan. What do? They stop. And because I've been running after the longan long enough, that longan, as soon as they stop, because of momentum, the longan actually goes further away from them. Goes really a long way away from them. Twice as far as it's ever been before. But the donkey just sits there, meditating. No worries, just sleepy, restless, whatever, just meditating, not getting anywhere. They're just waiting. And then, when the longan goes to the end of its trajectory, the longan stops and starts swinging back to the donkey. And there you are, just being a passenger, not doing anything. And the meditation, hey, it's starting to happen now. See, beautiful breath and nimittas and jhanas. It all comes towards you. The donkey just sits there. As long as it's already swung up to its extremity and then starts swinging back like a pendulum towards the donkey. And soon it comes right close to the donkey's mouth, but there's one thing the donkey has always to remember, which is compassion, loving kindness. So when it comes really close to the donkey's mouth, the donkey has to remember, Longan, the door of my mouth is open to you. You ever see the big teeth which donkeys have? Otherwise it just bounces off the teeth. So that's the last bit of compassion. Let it go, stopping and opening the door of your mouth to the fruit. That is what means by being a passenger. Striving long enough, now to stop and see what happens. It's one of the reasons why on this retreat, and say, take it easy, stop chasing things. Stop seeing if you can beat your PB, your personal best, of when you get up in the morning and how many hours you can meditate on the seat. So don't take a record. Okay, this morning was, I got up here at 4:20 and I managed to sit still till the morning chanting at 6 o'clock and I did another hour in the afternoon. That is just so much spiritual materialism. So don't do that. Just be a passenger, a friend to your mind. And just see how peaceful and still and how joyful and how easy is this path when you get out of the way and let it happen. So anyway, that's enough now. So I think I told you yesterday that I need to join a therapy group. I think I said that already, no, about those people who talk too much. It's based on Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called On and On and On and On Anonymous. That's right, I can go all night talking anyway. So anyway, enough for tonight. So let's now, what do we do at the end of a talk? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so those who want to go to bed, just your mattresses await you. But don't try to go to sleep, but just relax and enjoy and just remember some of the funny stories and just laugh and just have fun. And if you can't go to sleep, just see how nice and warm that is. You can stretch out your legs, you can scratch, you can get really nice and toasty and comfortable. So afterwards, wow, I don't want to go to sleep. And as soon as that thought comes up, you really don't want to sleep, that's when you go to sleep. Okay. You don't have to go to sleep, you can stay here if you want. Questions which are answered here, I'll answer tomorrow.